we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
And the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, on unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, June the 14th, 2019. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And Jen Dobell, who's just popping in.
Hi. And someone special.
Jen's mom, Bev. Hi, Bev.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming. So today is our Father's Day show, and welcome to our Father's Day show. Father's Day is celebrated this Sunday, June the 16th, and on today's show, we will be paying tribute to vegan dads who are raising their children as kind, ethical vegans who see animals as their friends, not food, and who will speak up for injustices against other beings. Our first vegan dad interview will be with Kyle Schlieff, who lives in Kelowna, BC, and is raising his 12-year-old son. Kyle was very instrumental to the Meet the Victims Canada action that took place on April the 28th, volunteering as the bus driver to drive the occupant team of activists to the pig farm in Abbotsford at 6 a.m. Our second vegan dad interview will be with Hugo Slabbert. Hugo is based in Pitt Meadows in the Lower Mainland, and along with his vegan wife Serene, has raised their two young children as ethical vegans from birth. Being active in animal rescue in BC, Hugo and Serene have recently started a nonprofit organization called PEACE, People Ensuring Animal Care Exists. In both of these interviews, Kyle and Hugo will be sharing their vegan journey stories and what it's like to raise children as a vegan. What do their children eat? How do they view animals? How are they becoming activists for the world themselves? All of this is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned. And for our first interview today, we'll bring back local animal advocate David Isbister to give us his thoughts on the passing of Bill S-203 this week in Canadian Parliament. After being stuck in the bureaucratic system for over 3 years, this bill finally jumped all the hoops needed, and it will be banning the captivity of whales and dolphins in Canada, and that's going to be now enacted into law. Now, last Sunday, over 400 animal advocates from Vancouver and beyond participated in the annual March to Close All Slaughterhouses in taking over the streets of downtown Vancouver for a good 3 hours, I would say. I was there reporting on our Facebook live stream, so if you want to see what that was all about, feel free to view some of the videos that I posted live, and I'll put a few more up this weekend. Those are going to be on our Facebook page at Animal Voices Vancouver. So, Jen, I'm glad that you decided to pop in today because you were there at the march, and Sinead, you didn't make it there.
No, I wasn't so lucky this year, but I was watching some of the videos that you were all posting, and it looked like a great turnout.
Yeah, I was surprised when I got there a big bit late that there were still around 400 people there already, like in the hour before when I got there. So Jen and I, we participated in doing outreach leafleting, which is basically there's a march of hundreds and hundreds of people, and we're chanting and we're being loud and proud about our cause for animal liberation. And then it provides a perfect opportunity, I think, because you have a captive audience there right on the streets. And so Jen and I were leafleting. Jen, what did you get out of the leafleting that day?
I was wearing a pig mask.
Yes, and which was awesome.
I got a lot of heckling. One guy said, "You look like breakfast." And I went into McDonald's and I had dairy leaflets. I went up to a mother who was eating ice cream with her kids and I said, "Please read this." And she got very angry and said, "Don't show that to my kids." So she knew the dairy industry was horrific. I said, "If you know it's so bad, why don't you buy them vegan ice cream instead?" And yeah, she wanted me out of there, which is why I wore the pig mask, because I did plan to go into every restaurant I could along the whole parade route.
That's very ambitious.
Give leaflets to people who were eating the specific animals of the leaflets I was handing out.
I give the leaflets to the store owners because the workers are standing outside
Good
watching
idea.
Us, and I find they're always receptive to taking them, especially in their, I think because they're in the food industry. Mm-hmm. So that's just one of the few times of the year that I get to march in a parade style march, and you always have a big captive audience, and they want to know. I actually say to them, do you want to learn more about what we're here for? And then I give them one of the vegan outreach leaflets that it says, even if you like meat on it. So,
and I just want to say Kira Blaze gave a really good speak out.
Yeah, she certainly did. So we stopped at 4 intersections in downtown Vancouver. There were some great speakouts. I have them all filmed if you go to our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And then at 2 intersections, we did what is called a die-in, where all the activists laid down in the intersection of these busy streets for a couple of minutes with the screams of farmed animals being slaughtered being broadcast into the air with big speakers. And I hope that that was illustrative to the people there of what is happening in slaughterhouses. And one more quick point, because we're out of time here, but we did an impromptu protest, celebration, I should say, at the Canada Goose store right after when we
That's
were at
awesome.
Georgia Granville. About 200 of us stormed in, and there's video of it. Watch on the Facebook page. It's pretty cool. We were celebrating the big dip in the stock market for Canada Goose in the last couple of weeks, going down 37%. So that's why we were there. If you want to learn more, go on our Facebook page.
My mom's giving the thumbs up.
yeah. There's been a lot of interesting stuff going on for animals here in Canada just over the past week. Yeah, between the march on the weekend, there's been lots of other news, including Bill S-203. So
big news.
After 3 or 4 years, it was 2015 that Bill S-203 was first introduced. This is the so-called Free Willy Bill, which, as Allison mentioned, bans keeping and breeding cetaceans, which includes whales, dolphins, and porpoises, through amendments to the criminal code. And so this means up to $200,000 in fines for anyone who is found to be breaking this law. It will also outlaw captive breeding and the import or export of whales, their sperm or embryos, with exemptions for injured animals in need of rehabilitation and for scientific research. The law does not apply to animals currently in captivity, and the hope is that these animals who are still being held captive will eventually be retired to sea sanctuaries. So there's still a lot of questions here, and you'll hear some more from David on that in a couple minutes, but I think it is really great, especially after talking about this bill on Animal Voices here for so many years and all the hurdles that it's met with in the government and all the conservative opposition. But it's
they dragged it through the process, right? The conservatives did not want this bill passed, and they made it jump through the many hoops that I think really dragged out the process.
Mm-hmm. And really, the opposition, all the arguments that you hear against it, it's people talking about, oh, well, it's going to affect jobs. it's so just weird, you know? It's, again, just sort of prioritizing money over recognizing that these are sentient individuals who are being held captive. So this is a monumental moment, having this bill pass. But we do have local animal advocate David Isbister on the show now to share with us his thoughts on the passing of Bill S-203.
Hi, David, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been so long.
Yeah, really. This is your fourth time on the show in the last 6 weeks or so. You've been giving us updates on the happenings of the Vancouver Aquarium. And as of this week, there's more big news in Canada with regards to Bill S-203. This bans the captivity of all cetaceans, whales and dolphins in Canada. And it finally passed in Parliament this week. And I'm just wondering, can you give us your thoughts about that?
Well, it's a good step. It's not airtight, and it's not 100% perfect, but it's a good step, and we have absolutely everyone to thank except for Vancouver Aquarium and Marineland, who fought it the whole way lobbied conservative senators and did their absolute best to make sure that whales and dolphins and other cetaceans died needlessly for nothing more than selfish amusement. So no thanks to them, but lots of thanks to the great long-term activists and everyone who did a great job.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, this passing of this federal law in Canada, I know we've been working on it for years and years. I never thought it would actually happen. And you've mentioned that it's not perfect. So, for example, there's still the dolphins and whales that are currently in captivity. There's one at the Vancouver Aquarium, and I don't know how many at Marineland. Not only that, both the Vancouver Aquarium and Marineland, they typically and commonly lend out their cetaceans. And it was just in the news recently that there was a beluga whale who was being sent to Spain. So what's going to happen to those animals in captivity since they're in limbo, I would say? They're in other countries. Are they allowed back into Canada? Like, what is their fate?
Yeah, so there's a lot of questions around that. We know for sure that, they're going to have these other populations that they've stolen from or purpose-bred. Those are going to be grandfathered, I suppose, including all of the many belugas that are currently pregnant at Marineland. So that's about 50 animals, 50 individuals that are due or being held. Vancouver Aquarium probably still has interest in about 7 to 10 other belugas. We're not 100% sure because obviously there's some that we've recently only just heard about. And the thing that's not airtight about it is that there's not a huge focus on sanctuary or rescue, just sort of the prohibition of display. There are these a little bit murky or a little bit nebulous sort of references to rescue and rehabilitation or even scientific research. So I'm going to be cautious and hope that that isn't anything too heinous or wording that is a little bit more clear when I get my hands on like the full bill, like how it ended up and how it was voted. So maybe there's a little bit more language in there, but it's a decent step. And I just think that we have a lot more we can do for cetaceans with respect to proper sanctuary, cordoning off bays and lagoons where individuals with behaviors that are rooted in diving can dive and forage and at least stretch out a little bit more. We realize that isn't perfect either, but certainly it's a huge step away from concrete tubs. And I think even in symbolic gestures and in principle, we should try to give back a lot of what we took away, a sort of a reconciling of our past harms on those species and do better by them. So I'm hoping that there's room to still lobby for the Vancouver Aquarium to become more like what they say and do actual rescue with a focus on rehabilitation. But we also know from the history of these places that that is statistically not likely. So we're going to have to all be vigilant and watch out for how these loopholes are used if they are.
Speaking of the history of the Vancouver Aquarium, I just want to have our listeners understand what it means to have animals in captivity. I know you have a lot of knowledge about all of the numerous deaths of cetaceans that there has been in the decades until now at the Vancouver Aquarium. Can you touch upon that for our listeners to explain why captivity is not the answer?
Sure. The greater campaign against CASA is notable. If you look at somewhere like Calgary Zoo, a CASA accredited facility where one of the current animal welfare managers at the Vancouver Aquarium worked already. We have 350 deaths in the last 10 years, many of them due to negligence and sort of preventable human error, absurd accidents. We've got touch ray pools where all the rays die simultaneously after someone put an effluent pipe back into the water and poisoned them. We've got a CASA accredited facility being shut down in the last 3 years after video of abuse of a tiger. We have John Nightingale and Clint Wright of Vancouver Aquarium accrediting Marineland the year before Marineland drew 13 animal cruelty charges. And then in Vancouver Aquarium itself, another apparently purportedly world-class CASA facility. We've had 9 of 10 captive bred belugas dead before the age of 3. 5 out of the last 6 beluga deaths completely without reason, without a suitable reason. They don't know why they died. We've had a failed orca breeding program. And overall, if we're just looking at cetaceans and not all the other poor zoo animals that are held there, if we're just looking at cetaceans, we've got 44 deaths that we know of for sure in 53 years. One every 1.3 years. And in their last year of keeping cetaceans, they lost 4. In the last year of 2016 and a little bit of 2017, if you count like a year from sort of halfway through. The last 4 that died all died in the span of just a little over a year. And again, no distinct reason, despite world-class care, despite all these purportedly better practices, which include drugging and filing down teeth, which include manual extraction of sperm through a sort of sex assault act where whales are masturbated or collected from, and then females are artificially inseminated. Lots and lots of stuff like that in the past, and not in the distant past, in the relatively recent past. So.
Right. Thank you for explaining that. And to our listeners who don't know what CASA is, it's really a corrupt society. It's Canada's accredited zoos and aquariums. It says advocacy organization on their website.
Right. But what that actually is a self-led, industry-run regulatory body that sets the rules for captivity using the people who are executives at the zoo. In fact, there's no CASA facility that uses an outside panel to determine who is rescuable or which animals would fare well. They purpose breed animals from stock originally that was wild caught, and I don't refer to them as stock, but I'm kind of saying like what the way they're treated. These are just stock. These are attractions. These are animals meant to draw people in and earn money under the guise of pretend conservation that demonstrably and measurably harms animals. So CASA and places like Vancouver Aquarium and other marine amusement parks use the banner of CASA to hide and skirt regulations that the SPCA could enforce or other humane societies could draw attention to. And they have in the past.
Okay, and finally, I want to speak a little bit about setting a precedent and what this means now that it's going to be federal law in Canada because of the passing of Bill S-203 this week. This law is banning the captivity of dolphins and whales in Canada. Do you think that this law in Canada now is going to change the tide with regards to how our society, even globally, feels about keeping wild animals in captivity, particularly because there are so many SeaWorlds and other aquarium entertainment facilities around the world? It's still a big booming business. But, you know, normally people will take their kids to SeaWorld and they don't even think twice about it because it's good family fun. But now they're going to be seeing, oh, Canada has outlawed that. How do you think that will change how people think?
Yeah, I think it's evidence that the tide has already turned with Blackfish and with the aquarium, with the now recently retired John Nightingale. I'm just doing a terrible job of pretending to be an educator. You know, time revealed what these facilities were about, and there's still some people who are a little bit hesitant to see it, but at least the people who are hesitant to see it may engage with a different reality, and it might just become normal to them to see less animals in captivity, and that might create sort of an awakening. So I think there's a few ways to look at it. I'm not entirely convinced that the law won't be tested in some way, and that might bring up a new political engagement with the law, and I wouldn't doubt if the law tries to get challenged again in other ways, in an electoral sense as well. So I think it's a sign of ethics and people changing their ways a little bit, you know, willing to see one animal as greater than the others and therefore more advocatable, if that's a word, which I don't think it is, but you kind of get my drift. But I think what the bigger issue here we still have to work on as activists and as people opposed to captivity is that all animals deserve to live a life that they lead in their natural environments, taking measures to lead their lives, to direct their lives, to be possibly predated, to die in a manner that's natural to their species and part of a natural way of life that they've evolved to live. And where we can intervene and maybe rescue and release them and give one more chance or a couple more chances, that's noble work. But the intention has to never be profit. And I think some people, cautiously I say this, are more willing to recognize that. So I think we just have to keep chipping away and make sure we use this to advocate for other animals and mention that CASA does this to a great many different species, not just cetaceans, and draw the parallels and advocate for them all. Personal shout out to Annalise for all the amazing stuff she's done over the years. All of us are very inspired by your determination, and anything any of us have done, myself included, I'd like to dedicate to her ferocity in her amazing activism.
Yeah, I've known Annalise for many, many years now, and I feel like it's been about 20 years back in the day when we were working on Vancouver Aquarium. She's been through a lot.
Huge inspiration. Know your history, animal rights people. Annalise is a monstrous figure in a good way.
Thank you, David Isbister, local animal advocate in Vancouver, for coming back on the show today to give us your thoughts about the passing of Bill S-203 this week. I think some history has been made, but there's still more to be done. Thanks, David, and have a great weekend.
Did you know that Vancouver Co-op Radio CFRO 100.5 FM has over 90 different shows produced by over 350 community members? This wide range of programming produced by our diverse group of programmers ensures that we have a show you'll love. We have shows on feminism, spirituality, disability rights, politics, unions, and parenting. We play jazz, indie rock, reggae, blues, and folk. We broadcast in a dozen different languages and have more First Nations programs than any other radio station in Vancouver. Find your show on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. All different, all the time.
This Sunday, June the 16th, is Father's Day, and for the rest of today's show, we pay tribute to vegan dads who are raising vegan children in their efforts to teach not only compassion to all living beings, but also ethical and environmental awareness about the impacts of our food choices. We have the ability to vote with our forks three times a day in favor of a world where animals are treated with kindness and where global issue awareness plays an important role in our being. For our first vegan dad interview today, we speak with Kelowna-based Kyle Schlieff, who is raising his 12-year-old son, Dalimar, who has now chosen veganism as a lifestyle as well for himself. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi there.
Well, it's so great to have you on the show this week in honor of Father's Day. You are a vegan father living in Kelowna, and you're raising a vegan son. So first of all, I'd love to hear about your vegan journey.
So my vegan journey happened just roughly 2 years ago. I started out being, you know, raised up like most everybody else, just meat every day. It was just like a normal thing, and just slowly progressed to a more kind of plant-based lifestyle just because I loved animals. I grew up in like a hunting kind of fishing culture, and I never really liked it, and just slowly realizing more and more that meat's not really necessary in our regular diet, and just slowly started like to cut out all milk, all meat from the grocery list. And then one day almost woke up realizing that I'm already vegan once I had already met someone else that was on the vegan train too, and I just completely identified with that's what I want to be. That's the lifestyle that I want.
Well, it sounds like you were born as a pre-vegan, as I say that many of us were. Like, we just realized, like, we don't want to do that. It makes sense to be vegan, right?
That's 100% correct, yes.
Right.
Why harm something if you really don't need to, right?
Exactly. So you have a 12-year-old son named Dalimar, and can you talk about what the journey has been like since you've only started on your path 2 years ago, and he's 12. What was that like to being now a vegan dad who wants to raise his child vegan?
That's an interesting question. I wanted him to make the kind of connection on his own. So I felt that in the long run, if I wasn't pressuring him into, hey, look, now there's no meat in the household, this is the way it is now, I wanted him to make that connection on his own. I introduced him to some other children that were also vegan to kind of normalize that in his life. So we met a few of the animals. I'm just kind of popular animals that you would eat, and he likes them. He likes basically chickens and cows, and then ask him, you know, if you'd like to eat them, and his answer is obviously no. You know, no one likes to hurt the animals. Mm-hmm. So he's just slowly made the connection on his own, and now he's almost 100% kind of plant-based. Now he won't even eat chips if there's any milk products in them anymore, and that's great.
Yeah, that's an amazing transition for a young child to basically make his own decisions based on the information that you have given him, and you are his father, like son. I think he was probably born a pre-vegan as well with the compassion that you have. Can you tell us what happened when you got a phone call from his teacher one day?
Oh, yeah. It was quite an interesting phone call. He was on a lunch program with the school, and he just one day just realized that, hey, look, there's meat in this lunch, and he just basically told all the adults there that he can't eat this because there's meat in it, and he wants a meat alternative, one that, you know, is not going to be harming the animals. So one day at work, I just got this phone call that was, so your son is not eating any meat anymore, like, what's up? And so I had to explain to her that, you know, I've been vegan for over a year now, but I haven't kind of forced it upon him, and I want him to make the decision on his own. And she's like, yeah, well, he's now claiming to be vegan. So I told her, well, I guess I'll have to be packing some lunches now. So that's quite excited now that I actually get to pack my own vegan lunches for him now that he doesn't want to eat what's available there.
That's great. Great. And I bet you were a proud vegan father when you heard that story from the teacher.
100%. Yeah. That just made my day.
So speaking of packing his lunch, I think you're the primary cook probably for your son. Like, what kinds of foods do you like to give to him? Or what foods does he like?
So that's a great question. He has always been an extremely picky eater. But he loves spaghetti. So spaghetti is kind of like our kind of go-to, easy to prepare. You can make a lot of portions. You can store them. So spaghetti is probably his kind of go-to lunch item. And he doesn't mind eating it kind of cold. So that's no big deal
that
for him.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah. Other than that, kind of, these are the peanut butter sandwiches and things like that.
What do you cook at home for dinner?
I love anything that's kind of Thai food, so lots of stir fries, lots of whole foods like rice and lentils and chilies and, yeah, kind of coconut kind of curries. Like, that's what we eat at home.
Sounds delicious. Same kind of food that I like. So you participate in animal activism where you live in Kelowna. There is quite a movement that's been started there in the past couple of years. And I saw some Kelowna Okanagan people at our march to close all slaughterhouses in Vancouver today. But you had a march to close all slaughterhouses yesterday in Kelowna. Do you involve your son with your activist efforts in Kelowna?
Yes, whenever I'm able to, I like to bring him out. I do like to see him hanging out with the other vegan kids to try to normalize this. This isn't, you know, it's not extreme as everyone really tries to claim it is. It's just, we're just a group of people that we don't want to harm animals. There's nothing extreme about that. I want him to be able to have other friends that kind of share the same views, and I bring him out to meet those kids and to try to be proud, you know, to be involved in this and to be making those choices on his own. So he's out there, he was out handing out flyers and stickers to other people as we were marching by them. And the march itself was great. There was a lot of people honking their horns that were really supporting us. Yeah, it was really great.
That's great. You know what, one thing I really love is vegan parents who are raising their children to be activists, because I don't think you see a lot of that. I know that when I do go out to these events, it's just the vegan children that are there. I just don't see or hear of other kids going out to advocate for other social justice movements. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that and what your thoughts are about in raising your child not only as a pro-vegan person, but as someone who gets out there to do outreach about veganism and about animal rights issues.
Well, so I bring him out there because I also want to spend that quality time with him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just one other thing that we kind of share and, you know, to kind of grow together. And I do want him to be able to take control of his life. And I think activism is one of the greatest ways that, you know, we can get out there and, you know, just being regular people, like, we can be heard. We can try to grow this and just bring awareness to everyone that's still in the dark, that doesn't really understand where their meals are really coming from or how their meals are raised or who they're eating instead of just what it is, but actually who they're eating is really meaningful. So,
and I think it can be very empowering for a child to grow up that way, knowing that they have a voice and that they can educate others and that the whole world isn't necessarily all right, all correct when they're eating animals and only a small fraction of us aren't. So I think you're teaching him a good thing there in knowing that what he's doing is right.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So finally, what advice do you have for parents who say are going vegan like you did and they already have kids and then they want to raise their children to be the same? What advice would you have for them to get started with that?
I would just say to not be afraid of trying new things. And like everything with raising children, I believe that there's no one way to do it. And I think just experiment with your child, try to do activities that draw connection to those animals and to not try to hide what's actually happening. Like, through these activism events, you know, Cubes of Truth, where we screen basically footage of like what's happening on these kind of farms, and I see other adults walking by hiding their eyes. I think that if you don't want your children to be seeing what's happening, then obviously there must be something wrong. So I think just let them know, because they really need to know what's happening. If you want them to make the right basically choices on their own, right, then they have to know. So knowledge is where it really all comes into play, is knowing what's happening, who you're eating, really.
Yes, and I think that some parents might try to shield their children from this knowledge because they think it'll hurt them, but what I find is that the children are open and receptive to the message, and actually children have more open compassion than we do as adults, because they haven't been scarred with, hopefully, experiences yet that most of us adults have by the time we're becoming a young adult. They are pure, and I feel therefore they're way more open and compassionate to receiving the message, and they know they can see what the truth is for itself.
I believe so too. I mean, most of the kids, they'd rather eat the apple and kind of play with the animal than play with the apple and eat the animal, right? So
exactly.
It's I think most of the children are leaning more towards a vegan lifestyle anyway. So,
well, one more thing I just wanted to acknowledge and thank you so much for being our bus driver for the Inside team at Meet the Victims Canada. It was very much appreciated, and you held a really large role that day. Do you have any thoughts to give on what happened that day in Abbotsford at the Excelsior Hog Farm?
I think that was a really, really, really big day for me. It was one of the very first major events that have really happened in Canada. I was proud to be part of that whole group of just amazing people. I've never been in that vicinity of, that many amazing people. There's 180 of us, and I think the more of that goes on, it's just going to lead to more and more change, and hopefully more people won't be afraid to speak up and try to show what's really happening.
Exactly. And we here at Animal Voices did a show the week after dedicated wholly to Meet the Victims Canada, and we had exclusive interviews with activists really showing all the sides that the mainstream media never told you about, because they didn't know, they didn't bother to check or to look. And I think that from what I understand, there's going to be some repercussions happening from that day coming up sooner than later, even though what you've heard in the mainstream media says other. So watch out for that. And thank you so much for being a very important role in that day, Kyle.
You're very welcome.
So that's all for today. I want to wish you a happy Father's Day for this weekend, a happy vegan Father's Day. Thank you so much and have a great weekend.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
For our next Vegan Dad interview, we have Hugo Slabbert on the show. He is based in Pitt Meadows in the Lower Mainland with his wife, Serene, and his two young children, Luca and Kira. Along with his wife, he has raised his children vegan from birth. Hello, Hugo, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks for coming today on our special Father's Day themed show. We are speaking to vegan dads who are raising vegan children, and that's you. So to start, I'm really interested to hear your vegan journey story. Everyone has one. What's yours? When did your journey start, and how did you transform to veganism?
Sure. Actually, for me, it started in university. I was taking some philosophy courses, and that got me thinking and kind of looking at, values and how do we kind of consider what we value versus others, and if we're deciding is this a good thing to do or not, how do we make that decision? And that got into, at least for me, it was a discussion between my then girlfriend, now wife, and myself around that. And vegetarianism for me at that point was more around kind of the weight that we put on our food systems and what the knock-on effects of that are. And when I looked at it, I couldn't justify for myself contributing more to that. We're just putting very heavy environmental demands on our food system. So I said for myself and my girlfriend, now wife as well, that we can make the decision ourselves for our preference and not consume animal products or not to consume animals at that point, and kind of like just step back and help shift that balance back a bit. So that was kind of the first step. I'd started to, through my wife or my fiance then, myself, had learned more about the impact of, say, the dairy industry and what that entails. So that was kind of the vegan step, and that was just before we got married and around 6 or 7. And since then, it's kind of just been, as you're involved in, you know, the vegan community, and as you're learning and exploring more about how our food systems work, you find out more, not just for me, about the environmental impact, but also these are individuals with their own choices, and I just can't justify that, you know, taking that from them. It's shifted more from just environmental impact for me into something that's a bit more personal.
Right. So, but when people say that they eat meat because eating is a personal choice, what do you have to say to that?
Well, you know, that's nice to also say that it's a personal choice for, you know, if I were to attack someone, but that robs them of their personal choice not to be attacked. So it's not a personal decision. If it inflicts harm on somebody else, you're not making that decision in a vacuum. So we have, you know, we have that notion of free choice and, you know, our state human rights, is that my freedom to do whatever I choose stops when it starts to impose on your own freedoms to be free from harm. So I think the same thing extends to animals.
Yeah, I think those are very good values to pass on to, say, children who you're deciding to have and raise. So let's talk about that. You and your wife were already vegan, it seems like, when you decided to have children. You now have Luca, your son, who is 6 years old, and Kira, your three-year-old daughter. So can you tell us what that is like when parents are vegan already? What were the steps involved in deciding, do I raise my children vegan, or was it obvious that you were going to raise your children vegan?
Well, I think we kind of had to look at it and not, you know, you're stepping into something that's a complete unknown for you. And when you're having your first child, there's so many things to consider, and you really don't know what you're getting into. So yeah, my wife and I, and she's very good on looking into, you know, researching these things. And we said, well, is this something that is safe for her to do in terms of caring for, you know, for actually she's pregnant with her first child? And so she did a lot of looking into that and determined that, yes, you know, this is something that we can do, and we can ensure that all of the nutrition that is needed for him is available. So it was not something that was done lightly, and we absolutely did consider it. It wasn't like a done deal. And similar thing when it comes to also after he was born, and looking at, okay, people will challenge this and say, is this actually safe for your child? And we now know there's much more in terms of like scientific reports and conclusions coming out that it absolutely is safe for all stages of life. But, you know, we also can't take that at face value. Like, we can't just say we're going to have a vegan diet and just cut things out but not replace those. So we still had, even like though we had personal confidence that this was safe and absolutely something that we can do and support Luca and Kira as well when they're born and growing and developing, we still did kind of like a sanity check thing for ourselves. Like, can we go and get like a blood panel just to make sure that all the things that they need are taken care of? And, you know, we've done that for Luca, we've done that for Kira, and each time the answer has been absolutely, your kids are perfectly healthy and they're fine. They're well taken care of.
Right. Isn't it strange when people are raising meat-eating children, no one says anything about their health, but when you're raising vegan children, people start asking you, oh, are they getting enough protein? Where are they getting all their nutrients from? And you even had your doubts, but I would think that as far as everything I've heard, all the vegan children I know of are perfectly healthy and they are thriving.
Well, and I think it's whenever something is not the norm of what people are used to. I mean, I think that's even for like personal health, is, you know, adults making their own decisions as opposed to before it extends to their children. People kind of go with the flow and like, well, this is the way I was raised and I was always fine, and they just go with it. But they don't really consider, am I getting the nutrition I need? And often they're not. But when you start to make that decision that you feel you might get challenged on in taking a different diet or taking a vegan diet, you do a bit more due diligence on it, and you pay a bit more attention to it. So I think absolutely people that even have a non-vegan diet could stand to benefit from just looking at what are their food choices and ensuring that they're healthy. And then they can perhaps also see that, well, you know, a vegan diet does offer them what they need. But yeah, it's definitely that if it's something that's the exception or not what people are used to, there's going to be more challenging towards it. But at least in our case, I think there's a situation where since you're challenged, you do more due diligence and you actually come out knowing more and having more confidence in your choices.
Right. So what is it like to have two children who have never eaten meat, and what kinds of values are you instilling into them? And I think they've had a lot of exposure to non-human animals as well, right? So can you give us a bit of an insight of what that is like, maybe compared to other children who you've known or do know who are not vegan?
Well, I think, you know, children are a great mirror because there's no filter there. So there's often things that we may skirt around that they'll just bring right out. And, you know, a great example for me around that was Luca. At some point, because we had always tried to approach it in, like, honestly for him about why we're making this choice to have a vegan diet. And for us, it's very much around, like, well, we don't want to harm animals and there's no reason for us to. So we eat and we consume things in a way that we don't bring harm to animals. And because he also does have, you know, a personal relationship or a relationship with animals, as we would farm animal sanctuaries and such, that really resonates. So there's a sense of him taking that on himself. But anyhow, so it popped up at one point in a conversation where Luca, just out of the blue, was chatting with my wife and said, "Mom," he's like, "Yeah." It's like, "Other people do eat animals, right?" I'm like, "Yes, they do. And we don't." And, you know, we've kind of spoken about that. When he said, it's like, "Well, but that's not nice. And we should tell them." And there's a bit of like a smack on the face moment there of, you know, we sometimes feel that we kind of want to hide a little bit. And that was a bit of a click moment of, at least for my wife, embarking on a bit more of a, you know, her own activism and being a bit braver and just stating what she feels and what her choices are and being a bit more direct about that. So there's, I think, having made different choices and having, you know, a vegan diet in this case, we sometimes feel somewhat scared for our kids of being different. And standing out. And absolutely, there have been times where there's been mocking or bullying and things that happen in schoolyards because kids, that happens. But there's really a sense of confidence and resilience as well that I think has come with that, where I'm quite proud of Luca and of Kira and how their straightforwardness in terms of how much they care for animals.
That's wonderful. I think you're both raising very aware children who are activists. They're already starting to be activists, and that's amazing. So what do your children like to eat? What do you feed them?
I can't stop them from eating field dress burgers. That's always...
Oh, those are yummy.
Luca will literally term that his favorite patty.
That's a luxury item.
So there's that. Kira, for some reason, I don't know why, for one of her birthdays, we had kind of like a finger food thing, and we had gotten, you know, the chow cheese slices.
Yeah, I know those.
And that now became named her birthday cheese. So she'll ask for her birthday cheese. So that's a common thing. The kids, they can't stop with potatoes. Veggie burgers and fries, or just fries, are a constant thing. So for us, that's usually the bribe item, is that it's like, okay, well, you have to eat this, and then you can have two fries. So potatoes are just like a fact of life and a half. So those are kind of the standard ones. And sushi. So we do a lot of avocado rolls and,
that's healthy.
You know, edamame beans and seaweed salad and that sort of thing.
Do you think your kids have a more diverse taste palette than other kids in their age range?
I think so. And I don't think that's necessarily just a vegan diet thing. But because we, you know, try to pay attention to what we eat, it's like our snacks would have often been, you know, carrots or an apple or a pear or something, as opposed to, you know, a treat out of a wrapper or something. Mm-hmm. So they've got that, and there are nuts over avocados. So I think they've got that exposure, or they may actually snack on, like, broccoli that's just out of the fridge. That goes in stages, right? Mm-hmm. Where they'll kind of pull back, and like I said, it'll just be veggie burgers and fries, and you have to try and convince them for anything else. They do seem to have kind of a mix.
So can you tell us a little bit about your animal activism that we were speaking about the other day? Just tell us about a few things that you've done lately.
Sure, yeah. I mean, Serena's kind of the one that leads the pack. She's very much, she has kind of a philosophy of, if it scares her, then it's something she has to take on.
Oh, that's the same as me.
She's a strong woman. So she dove very much into that. And because especially she had a fear of talking to people or public speaking, she started getting involved in Anonymous for the Voiceless and slave movements. So she's active on that front. But we also do have relationships with a lot of the local animal sanctuaries. We visited there and have helped out. So Serene had, through connections through AV, Anonymous for the Voiceless, she had heard of basically a pig that needed a home. And that ended up being the first kind of rescue that she was involved with a pig named Big Mama. And we had a second opportunity over this past Christmas when there was the Christmas calves that needed to find a home that was from a dairy in Abbotsford. And Serena was basically over Christmas and Boxing Day trying to wrangle and communicate with people and sort out where we could find a home for them. And on Boxing Day, we ended up driving Rusty up to Kelowna to Arion Therapeutic Farm there. So from that experience, and both from Big Mama and with the calves, mm-hmm. we ended up seeing that often it can be a bit of a scramble of just trying to see, like, you know, half a dozen different people calling a whole bunch of different animal sanctuaries and then being a bit bombarded. And it does get quite hectic. Mm-hmm. So we kind of just started thinking of how we can help simplify that and make that a bit more manageable. So we ended up founding a nonprofit called PEACE, People Ensuring Animal Care Exists. And PEACE's mission is to, well, ensure animal care exists through supporting the work that farm animal sanctuaries do with things like, okay, if an animal does need to be rehomed or needs to find a home, let's have processes for how we do the logistics. Let's figure out where all the sanctuaries are. Let's become a central contact point that if people can just contact PEACE, and we can, rather than having, you know, a dozen people call all the different sanctuaries over and over, we can ensure that we place them or find them a home. So we talk about refuse resources and education. We're starting to develop programs in schools or trying to see how we can do that for compassionate education as opposed to things like dissection, how can we find alternatives, or things like egg hatching programs, how can we find alternatives. So that's kind of a bit of a broad strokes look at that.
I think that's fantastic that you two are working on that because you're in the community of the young kids in schools, and that's where it's needed. And I think it was just maybe last week I saw a video of your wife, Sarian, speaking about PEACE at some vegan market or something. And I bookmarked that on my Facebook. I'm like, I want to talk to her at some point. That sounds great. Yeah. And now I'm speaking to her husband. So, yeah. So what message would you have to fathers about taking on the responsibility as a global citizen to raise children who are going to grow up in a world that, in which hopefully we'll have a world when your kids are getting older, right? But growing up, but raising them in a responsible manner where they are ethically responsible and they are treating the resources on the earth in a friendly manner, and hopefully they're advocating for peace and nonviolence and compassion. I mean, you would think all fathers would do that, right? But maybe not so much the non-vegan fathers, but I think that's I would hope that is some common ground that fathers right. and parents in general can share. But what message do you have to fathers for Father's Day on how they can foster those values in their children?
You know, I think it's any decisions that we make in terms of how we raise our children, whether we go with, quote, go with the flow kind of thing, or whether we make a decision that stands out, that's still a choice we make. So if we think that we're, you know, opting out by just going with what the defaults are, right. you still are actually making a decision that has moral implications. That is a moral judgment. So I think that we need to have some confidence to be able to stand up and to stand out. And I think have a bit of confidence also in your children and their resilience and their ability to understand some of these things. It's like, compassion is something that's inborn, it's natural. They can actually show us more how to be brave and how to take that stand. I think we often perhaps give ourselves a little bit too much credit in children, not too much, when they often can show us that they can take those steps, they can understand these are animals that have similar feelings to us, that have emotions to us. So it's almost more listening to them to a degree and also having confidence in that we don't have to always protect them and shy them away from things that we think will be difficult or things we think that will make things harder for them if they stand out. I guess that's kind of the thing.
That's a great answer. I have one more question for you regarding veganism as a man and a father. Mm-hmm. How does veganism define your character and your role as a man and a father? A message for all the fathers out there.
Good question.
Or have you ever thought of that? You know, it's an issue, masculinity and veganism.
Right, yeah. You know, I think things are shifting a bit and we're seeing some more public figures and role models that help bust the idea of, you know, preconceptions that people can have around compassion as being weak, or that all vegans are all skinny, or that sort of thing. So I myself do a lot of cycling. So I time cycle to work, but I'll do 100 kilometers a week. I ran my first half marathon last year. Awesome. I've taken up Krav Maga in the last year, so that I'm working with self-defense and something that's quite physical. I think we don't need to limit ourselves just based on a dietary decision. Mm-hmm. And even for myself, that's more on the physical side. But if you look at the notions of compassion,
yeah.
I have for some time I've been involved in meditation practice with basically a Buddhist school, and that has us start thinking of seeing how challenging it is to actually face up to our own thoughts, our own internal world. And that's actually the thing that's courageous, is to look at what's going on for ourselves and to be willing to be compassionate, to be willing to show kindness, and to not just be aggressive towards things and have to exert, you know, power and dominance over top of things. Like that actually ends up being a somewhat easy way out. So I meandered a little bit there, but I think if I could sum it up, it's like, don't feel that you're limited by, oh, these are the preconceptions around what I need to be if I'm compassionate or a peaceful person, then I have to be me. Because like, we can be direct, it takes courage to do those things. And in terms of like your own physical things around masculinity or whatever you feel around sports or athleticism, it's like, there's lots of people that are showing that we can do perfectly fine and sometimes even try better on vegan diets.
Including yourself, you're leading by example, and I hope people know it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, any plans for Father's Day this weekend?
Well, at the moment, I think we do have some family coming over. We're actually hanging out with the folks at Little Oink Bank, Pig Sanctuary in Aldergrove a lot. And so we're going to invite some family out here on Saturday for like a barbecue.
Not barbecuing pigs, though, right?
No. No, definitely not. They're like, I'm living with the cats right now. They're right outside here.
Yeah. That's wonderful. It's been a pleasure to hear about your veganism as a parent and your wife and raising your two children vegan. And I hope that this can serve as an example to all other parents out there who wish to live a compassionate life as well. Have a happy Father's Day this weekend.
Thank you very much.
And now we have an event. One event we want to talk to you about today, Dog Wab. We've mentioned on the show before, Dog Wab stands for Day of Giving Within Arbitrary Borders. And it started as a response to the context-devoid Canada Day 150 celebrations that ignore marginalized groups and reinforce oppression, colonialism, and many other stigmatized phobias and judgment-based harms inflicted on our fellow earthlings. You know, we're an animal advocacy show, but humans are animals. So Dog Wab takes place on Monday, July the 1st. And what it is basically friends pooling resources together and gathering to distribute needed items in the downtown east side. So you can volunteer at the actual give on July the 1st. But we're also helping collect donations here. You can, they want to raise $2,000, is it, Allison?
Yeah, because we fell short on our last event, so we're just trying to catch up a bit. And what this money goes towards is to mainly buying food ingredients that then we will put together in David Isbister's commercial kitchen on the weekend leading up to, and that help is needed for the food prep as well. And I have to say that's probably, for me, the funnest part. Also, I really enjoy collecting reusable items that people would otherwise throw out. So I'm always collecting water bottles. There's a free store that I go to on campus and they always have stuff like that. I'm collecting winter wear, scarves and hats for next year, actually. And then we're collecting reusable tote bags as well. I would say that that's a need too, because what we do is we set up the free store. I don't know how many meals we're going to be making this year, this time. Usually it's between 300 and 600, so I don't know the exact number. But last time when we did it, we actually lined up our free store right outside the Vancouver Co-op radio station right here at Columbia and Hastings. Right here we're stationed at the radio station, basically in the heart of where all this poverty is happening in Vancouver. And so I think it's so important to give back if you can. And if you can't be there to volunteer, we accept cash donations as well. And that's on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if anybody would like to learn more information about this event or to arrange to donate something, whether it's cash or toothbrushes or tote bags or anything, you can...
Ask your dentist for toothbrushes and toothpaste. That's what I'm going to be doing next, and they've always have helped out in the past. Please do that, and then get on our Facebook page or just message me on Animal Voices Vancouver, and we'll figure out how to get them from you. The location where we collect all this stuff is near the Main Street SkyTrain station.
Mm-hmm. So again, the event itself is on Monday, July the 1st, and to find out more, you can go to the event page on Facebook, DogWab, that's DogWab, and that'll be posted on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. If you have an animal-friendly event that you'd like to have announced on the show, please send it to info@animalvoices.org or send us a message, as I mentioned, through our Facebook page. So you have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio on unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us on our next show next Friday, June 21st, when we'll be honoring Indigenous Peoples Day. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts. Subscribe via iTunes. You can also find us on Google Play Podcasts, and you can now follow us on Instagram,
which we started last weekend.
Yeah.
The March to Close All Slaughterhouses last Sunday. That was my debut in trying to figure out how to use Instagram. So you'll see my awkward videos there. If you look in the highlights section, which I learned you have to put them in.
Yes, it's a learning process for sure. So our handle is Animal Voices Vancouver.
And I've been making posts during this show as well, so you'll want to check those out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at info@animalvoices.org. And to end the show today, we're playing a song called Angel of the Sea by singer-songwriter Cece Cox in honor of the dolphins and whales in captivity who want to live their lives freely in the oceans. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Dream like blue, translucent sea flowing all around me. I believe your energy called out to mine. You're so divine, and as I watch you, I'm amazed how any man could sell his soul and raise his hand to force your silence for eternity. As I swim deeper into myself, I as the tide must come to land, so I must free my angel of the sea. Your dream changes slowly. Now there's red surrounding me, not my own. I turn to stone. Your silent smile is your goodbye. And as I watch you, I'm amazed how any man could sell his soul and raise his hand to force your silence for a time.